I'm Rachel Allen.
And I'm Jack Underwood.
And this is the Faber Poetry Podcast.
In this week's episode, we have Ilya Kaminsky and Sophie Robinson.
And we have audio postcards from Daisy Lafarge, Anthony Anaxagoro, and Hugo Williams.
The willows on the common are still on fire. The willows on the common are still on fire. She lives in a combustible north. Memories, the engine she doesn't want, keep firing blanks at significance. In the obsolete commons of crayons and tarmac, children who resolve too soon to never play with matches end up setting themselves alight with fervour or goodwill. She keeps a sequin in her palm. She knows the sequin is a girl seed, a time capsule that must be artificial, disc-like enough to withstand its own heat. At weekends, she drives so far and long to bring foil-wrapped cake to a mother who will not eat, that her first big word is outskirts, as if the city is a mesh of cheap tulle and cigarette butts that a mother can get stitched into, and there never is an indication of having reached the outskirts, but she is always looking for a sign.
That was an audio postcard from Daisy Lafarge. Rachel, who have we got in the studio today?
Today we are talking to Ilya Kaminsky and Sophie Robinson. Ilya Kaminsky was born in the former Soviet Union and is now an American citizen. He is the author of a previous poetry collection, Dancing in Odessa, and co-editor of the Echo Anthology of International Poetry. He has received a Whiting Award, a Lannan Literary Fellowship, and a Guggenheim Fellowship, and was named a finalist for the Neustadt International Prize for Literature. His work has been translated into more than 20 languages. Ilya, what would you like to read for us today?
First of all, thank you for having me here. It's really a pleasure. I'll probably start by reading the first poem in the Deaf Republic. Is that okay? We lived happily during the war. We lived happily during the war. And when they bombed other people's houses, we protested, but not enough. We opposed them, but not enough. I was in my bed. Around my bed, America was fallen. Invisible house, by invisible house, by invisible house. I took a chair outside and watched the sun. In the 6 months of a disastrous rain, in a house of money, in a street of money, in a city of money, in a country of money, our great country of money, we, Pardivas, lived happily during the war.
And joining Ilya today, we have Sophie Robinson, who teaches creative writing at the University of East Anglia and is the author of A and the Institute of Our Love in Disrepair, and also Rabbit, her collection that came out this year or last year? Last year. She's currently working on a non-fiction book called Prairie Oyster. Sophie, what would you like to read for us today?
I'm going to start by reading Fucking Up on the Rocks. Ducking my head under each wave on Fire Island, I try to think of other times I've felt this done with life and survived. Frank O'Hara died here, everybody knows. Alcoholics die everywhere, all the time, everybody knows. He was purple wherever his skin showed. I never thought of myself as a useless drunk. I never felt so unspecial. Through the white hospital gown, in the daytime, it feels like it would be easy to die, to dip my head under just a second too long. But in the dark, death is real. Like an animal up close. He was a quarter larger than usual, on the edge of sleep, and you could fall straight into and through it, and nobody would know your name there. Naked in the Atlantic at midnight, cutting a path where the moon hits the water, I could swim a straight line out into forever, and nobody would stop me, would know my name. Every few inches there was some sewing composed of dark blue thread. I want to shut my eyes. I want to shut a million things. Strawberry moon, orange to silver, my simple tits, bobbing on the water. Some stitching was straight and 3 to 4 inches long. Others were longer and semicircular. Urge to die, breathing out and folding in on itself until it feels like nothing. We get out, shiver, lose the keys to the house, find them and laugh on the porch. The lids of both eyes were bluish black. Jameson drinking an inch of mezcal and me sucking on my seltzer like it's a beer. Alive, smiling, only half quitting, only half gone, a normal heart flashing in and out on the shore. It was hard to see his beautiful blue eyes, which receded a little into his head. The Wi-Fi is out, my 4G is fake, replacing each image in my recent life with a square and a question mark. I know, right? He breathed with quick gasps. His whole body quivered. I've taken a solemn vow to stop looking at your face on the internet, to stop imagining your unkind thoughts of me, my life as a little nobody. There was a tube in one of his nostrils down to his stomach. I go to sleep in a wood-panelled room, the same length and width as my bed, and I count the waves as they break over my head. I sleep like I'm already dead, face to the wall, greedy for the nothing, won't fall. In the crib, he looked like a shaped wound. I wake up constipated in the morning sun, drink coffee and smoke on the beach, feeling full of shit and good to no one. His leg bone was broken and splintered and pierced the skin. Every rib was cracked. A third of his liver was wiped out by the impact. I could make her home here, prone forever, belly to the sand. Let my messages go unread. Let my phone battery run flat. Let the sun burn my back. Let all the ships fuck up on the rocks. Indistinguishable, baby small, little pieces floating like the world floats. Gay, unbroken, bloated and golden. A monument to my favourite alcoholic, the greatest homosexual who ever lived and died.
Thank you both so much for those incredible readings. We often ask our guests to bring in a small item that may in some way speak to their poetic practice or represent their writing in some way, which is obviously an impossible task, but it's quite fun for us to have setting homework for you all. Ilya, what have you brought in for us today?
You know, I am in transit, so I didn't have anything on me. And I thought I would tell you a funny joke where Breen got a talisman, a country, which is no longer here. But then, as we began talking, I began playing with my wedding ring. Oh. And I thought, oh, I have something. And that something does have a story, a very long story, which I'm not going to say, because the point of a talisman is not to tell a story. Instead, I will tell you a little bit of how I got it. So,
do you mind if we see it, if we pass it around? Is that
you
okay?
Asking for ways.
Oh, it's nice. Yeah. Not that it, I was expecting it not to be.
Put it on, and now you're weird.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that. That's not my business. Okay, Sophie, do you want to have a look at that?
What's the story then of how?
Yeah, so there is a long story behind it, which I'm not going to say. What I am going to say is, my family left for U.S. in '93. But my brother, who is quite a bit older than me, about 15 years older, left 2 years before. And at that time, my parents, who were older parents, by Soviet standards, they were in their 50s, which was not a young age in that country, they said, we're not going, you're going fine, you're not going. And so they thought it was the last time that they would see him. Hmm. And we were in Moscow saying goodbye at the border. And then all of a sudden I see my mother running through patrol through the border and kissing my brother in the mouth, which was a really good thing to see when you were like 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And then later on, what happened is she gave him this ring.
Oh, wow.
By kissing him on the
mouth. This one?
Yes.
Oh, that's amazing.
And that was partly simply because she thought it might be the last time she saw him. Hmm. She wanted to give him something. Hmm. And that was the last impulse. But in 2 years, then so happened to inform the USSR that my parents had to leave as well.
Yeah.
And I got the win.
And Sophie, what did you bring for us?
That was such a lovely story. I bought this necklace, which is, I bought it for myself in New York about 3 years ago. from this jewellery designer I really liked, and it's called the Hand of God necklace. It's called Lady Hand of God necklace. Mm. And they have a bigger one that's called Hand of God. And this is just Lady Hand of God.
More dainty.
Yeah. And it was based... I bought it because it was the same design. It's a hand with a with one finger pointing. And it was the same design as the tarot card that C.A. Conrad pulled for me during this incredibly generous tarot reading that they did for me. And they explained to me that the card is called Jupiter's Finger, and it's about understanding, acknowledging and channeling your power, that you already have all the power that you need, but it's just a matter of like knowing it and channeling it. And at the time, I wasn't able to understand or channel whatever power I had. And I was feeling a bit sort of, I don't know, impotent for want of a less patriarchal word.
Lady impotent.
Lady impotent, yeah. Just a little, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had just been given some advice as well from a really good artist friend of mine. I had a series of really gutting rejections of a kind of early version of the manuscript for Rabbit. And I was finding it really difficult to kind of see a way forward. And I was trying to understand the kind of quite complicated, apologetic, British kind of critique of my work that meant that the publisher couldn't publish it. And my friend Hannes Ribartes, who's a really, really amazing visual artist, said to me in this like pub in New Cross somewhere that whatever it was that people were critiquing about my work was the thing that they noticed about it. And so I needed to take that thing and just amplify it and do as much of it as I could. Which seems like maybe not the best career advice, but for me it kind of was. And actually, like, the third section of the book in Rabbit is my favourite section. I hadn't written that yet. And that was when I decided to stop worrying about whether or not my poetry would be palatable to a certain publisher or a certain audience, and just wrote what I needed to write. And so that seemed to me like a manifestation of the hand, like kind of like trying to channel my power. And maybe my power is not in appealing to a great number of people, but in a certain intensity.
Ilya, it was wonderful to see your ring. And I'll ask you, I think, later about the sort of props and aspects of your book that occur throughout. But I wanted to sort of talk a little bit about how you worked the narratives of your story, of your book, into a two-act poem play, and why you chose to sort of write the book in this way. Did you feel like it was imperative to the narrative that you combined a kind of versification inside a play structure, and what drew you to wanting to have it in two acts?
I don't really believe in a genre division. I mean, the case of here in London, and you could say that perhaps when she was alive, Virginia Woolf was the best living poet in London, and the poem she wrote was Mrs. Dalloway, and so forth and so on. Or do Shakespeare's plays, do we consider them long poems, or do we consider them plays, and so forth. But in my case, in the way I see it, genre should answer, the decision to write in a specific genre should answer some kind of impossible question or obsession that the writer has. It should give shape to it, it should give form to it. In my situation, as I mentioned it, I came to the United States in 1993, and I began writing my first book, which was called Dancing in Odessa, and it was published in 2004, which was about 11 years after I arrived in the U.S. And so writing that book, I was a young deaf boy who didn't have hearing aids in Russia. So the way I saw the world was through the images. And coming to U.S. and finally getting the hearing aids and writing those poems in English, which I was learning at that time, I realize now that Dancing in Odessa was not really a book that I was trying to write in English as much as a book that I was trying to write in the language of images. And when I go back to look at the book, it's mostly written in images. But at the same time, it is very much a book about Russian poets, in conversation with those Russian poets, as if I was trying to carve a space in English for that person I was or that place I came from. But in 2004, I was already living in the United States for 11 years, and I was already dating the woman who would later become my wife. And she's American, and we spoke English at home. So the question I had to ask for myself, what am I going to do next? Am I going to, quote-unquote, play Russian again and write another book about the, you know, the past? Or do I try to find a way to find out who I am now? Because at that time, I wasn't quite a Soviet Jew from Ukraine whose native language was Russian anymore. I was a refugee in the United States. And so I didn't quite have models for the kind of things that I wanted to do, which was find out who am I. And I tried to write a book in more than one way. I published it, different versions of the story.
Yes.
Yes. Mm. There was also a puppet play, which didn't make an end of the book, but it was published separately 7 or 8 years ago, about 10 pages or so. So what I was trying to do is to really find what is the right form, what is the right language. And I realized it as time passed on that I was really looking to give a shape to a story or an image that would speak both for the Ukraine, where I'm from, which is a country at war and has been for 5 years, or United States, which where I live now, and which is also a country at war, a very different kind of war, war on the rest of the world and also the war on its own people, while at the same time being the most comfortable and richest place on the planet. So how do you find the language or a form that speaks to both? Mm. And for me, having written quite a bit and still looking, searching, that image of a boy lying on the street, killed by a soldier, is something that is both Ukrainian and yet very American. Mm. And the silence that surrounds the body of a child, around which people walk by for hours, is also very American, as it is Ukrainian. And so the story began to take shape, and by that time I already had a lot of different poems that could populate that story. And then the characters came because emotions came.
Do you think that you need to have some kind of limit, whether it's with it, syntax, whether it's vocabulary,
or even the language that you choose to write in?
Exactly, in order to sort of then find the dynamism to move beyond it. Do you think that you must to feel the constraint?
Are you asking me specifically, or by you, I mean a universal you?
Oh, I think you specifically.
Specifically, I strongly believe that you need tension. Mm. Limit is one of the forms of tension.
Mm.
There got to be some kind of tension in the work. Otherwise, I fall asleep.
Hmm.
The oldest quote that one can think of it, I don't know, something from early 20th century, Yeats, quarrel with another is a rhetoric, quarrel with yourself is poetry. Hmm. But if you think about it, Yeats really didn't make it up. She stole it from, say, Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. In Shakespeare and Hamlet speaks to other people in prose and to himself in verse, for the most part. So there's always this kind of tension. Limitation is a wonderful thing, meter, environment, so forth.
Where do you think the tension is, both with your writing and with this book? I feel like I could say what I feel like the tension is, but it would be interesting to hear where you placed the tension when you were thinking about Deaf Republic.
Partly because it took a long time to write. There's probably more than one for me. One example would be metaphor and denial of a metaphor. Mm. So you say something like, the body of a boy lies on the asphalt like a paperclip. The body of a boy lies on the asphalt like the body of a boy. Mm. So at first you give the reader a metaphor and then you deny it. But in order to deny it, you would need to build up a lot of metaphors, so the reader would expect this abundance of metaphor. Mm. And then when you have the most emotional moment, you deny it.
What I really like about that device of having the metaphor and then...
an undoing of the metaphor.
Yeah, is that metaphor often comes to the rescue poetically when ordinary language, when nouns become too familiar, the failure of ordinary language, and then the metaphor kind of rejuvenates or makes new the object, the tenor. But then to sort of then disavow the metaphor, the act, and to return it again to the word, which we already know is kind of a failed word, is a really kind of brutal...
And it reinstates the power of the word, of the plain language or the simple language without...
Well, I wonder if it reinstates it, but also with a kind of total desolation, that we know that this word isn't good enough, but we're going to have to use it because... there is the body of a boy, you know, and the sort of the factual aspect of it. This is interesting with your work, Sophie, because there are moments of lots of like images that sort of flash up. I love the way that the poem's kind of, it's interesting that you talk about a tarot reading, because there is a kind of like turning over a card and then somewhere we're somewhere else. You know, it does feel kind of like a hand being... turned over, like patience or tarot, or
a
something.
Series of realizations.
Yeah, and sometimes they're metaphorical, but sometimes it's the kind of brutal realism that comes through. That kind of again, like that provides us with a new kind of flash of clarity, a cold, desolate reality. Could you talk to us a bit more about kind of like how you think about your poetic in terms of image or truth or like the real or the metaphorical?
Yeah, and maybe it follows on from what Ilya was saying too, because you need the rest of it too. Like I often, I'm sure we all have this, but like I catch myself sometimes doing this thing that I've done in about five poems in Rabbit, at least five poems, which is I say all this stuff and then at the end I undo it by addressing the subject of the poem directly and being like, listen, actually what I wanted to tell you was this.
Which is why I'm telling you about it.
And in that poem, in Having a Coke With You, O'Hara gets away with saying, I look at you and I would rather look at all the portraits in the world, because of the yogurt and the orange flowers and all the detritus of everyday life around it. You can only have that like glimmering bit of the poem by itself, because... like, you can only have it amongst everything else. You can't have it by itself, because it would be a turn-off in the same way as if you broke someone's heart before you made them fall in love with the world, like Ilya said. It would...
Well, that's where the tension comes in, I think, because there's almost a frustration or a boredom with trope. It's like, I know the power in this. I know what it means to say, you know, about the thousands of portraits. You'd rather look at that someone's face than a thousand portraits. But there's like, it gets tiresome to want to perform that kind of affection or declaim that kind of love, and you just get desperate to say...
Well, Shakespeare does that all the time with sonnets. He'll have like this high, this sort of slightly baroque construct, this metaphysical construct, and then at the end in the little couplet he'll sort of turn to the addressee or turn to the rest of the world and say, see, I'm sexy, I'm really good and I really like you. You know, it's kind of like that switch at the end.
So when you break the fourth wall of the poem, that's kind of like a contemporary Volta.
A contemporary couplet.
Yeah.
I think about Samantha Walton, another poet on Boiler House, who has that line about kind of being sick of or hating the idea of like the addressee, these women being addressed by in love poems, like how awful that is. and like not wanting to be addressed in a love poem. When you're navigating the more personal, this kind of neo-lyric aspect... which I've sort of double lyric. How do you sort of weigh that tension and risk? I know that you're teaching students at UEA, and lots of my students admire your work, and having to try and like, I guess I'm asking for tips here. How do you know when you're being too personal, when you're being honest, when you're giving away too much, or when you're not giving away enough like that? How do you weigh that risk of being declarative, of being Sophie in a poem, writing a poem?
I don't weigh it up. I do nothing. I went on like a little book tour for Rabbit earlier this year, and I was in York and I did this kind of Q&A. I did a couple of Q&As like a couple of the events, and one of the questions I really remember clearly in York, and it came up again a couple of times in different Q&As, was like, your work is so like exposing and so full of shame, but like the kind of a rejection of shame, because I'm, you know, I'm not like ashamed enough to not say it. And I kind of get off on shame, I think. But they were like, how, you know, the questions were things like, how do you protect yourself? How do you know when you, how do you not give too much of yourself away? And I have no idea, and I don't. And like, I definitely have like had to do some self-care work in the in the aftermath of Rabbit being published, because I just felt like, I still have moments where I'm like, did I really tell people that much about myself? I think I always worry about obviousness or sentimentality, that some of the poems tip over into being embarrassing for the reader.
That's a play on a kind of shame as well, though, that I think is quite clever about your book. There's a sort of an abrasive, I don't feel embarrassed when I read it, but there's a definite awareness that there could be an embarrassment inherent in the poems, which is brilliant to read, I think, to be embarrassing or to own embarrassment in that way is a really clever part of the book.
Yeah, and I definitely had like had certain moments of the book where I was like, am I really, like I was playing chicken with myself, or I was like, am I going to keep that in? For some reason, it's the constipated line about Fire Island, and I was like, am I going to keep that in? Yeah.
I like the idea about sort of thinking about the self-care or the work that you have to do after a book is published, and the emotional response that you have to your work being received, sort of brings me back to your book, Ilya, and thinking about the emotional attachment you might have had to the characters in your book, because there's a definite relentlessness to the emotional and physical action of the poems. In the first poem, a boy just introduced to us is shot dead immediately, and throughout there is an uncompromising treatment of the characters, handled alongside their small but incredibly moving relationships. And I just wondered how it felt to create this scenario, to be kind of God in this universe, to in effect destroy it and raise it to the ground, and how you felt about managing the characters in the way that you did. And did you feel an emotional distance from them because of their place in the metaphorical construct of your book?
I don't know if when we talk about poetry, even when we talk about persona poetry, there is that much distance between the author and the speaker and the characters. I mean, essentially, any writer writes about being a human on this planet. And if you put one mask, or you put another mask, or you put 55 masks, it is still 55 versions of what it means to be a human on this planet. So it is still kind of coming back to that point we were talking about, the argument with the self. I will say, however, when you go to a funeral, one thing that you remember is not necessarily whose funeral it was or what food you had at the wake, but the strange thing that you saw somebody laughing. Or you go to a wedding and, you know, the parents of the bride or so forth or the groom are crying, and you remember that 4 days later, not how much you danced. So this kind of human conflicts are so much a part of who we are. Why would you not want to kill your favorite character?
And the idea of performing something as well. Do you ever feel like in your poetry there's a performance of a kind of an absolute extreme version of a self, which could be said, I think, for your poetry, Sophie?
Yeah, I do. And I think that it's something that I really noticed. Again, I guess I've given more readings in the last year or so than I have done ever before. And I really noticed it some nights, especially like doing consecutive readings, you know, like being in like doing like 4 readings in a week in different cities.
I love the way you both read in incredibly sort of unique, amazing ways. Maybe this would be a good time to hear you both read another poem.
Sure.
Would you like to start, Sophie?
Yeah.
Don't cry.
You can cry.
Safe space.
It's topical. I'm actually going to read the one that I finish pretty much every reading with, which is the one that people are like, I can't believe you did that, and they seem to be under the impression that I've like, that was the first time I've ever read it. So we'll do it again. Art in America. At dusk each day, I like to think of all my new friends in different parts of the city, jerking off, running baths, vaping weed, getting sober, running their mouths and reading poetry aloud to one another. Alice says I have the right to repeat myself, so I do. Alice says you can cry if you need to, so I do. She looks away, scrolls pictures of dogs on Instagram, and we watch the traffic dancing towards the bridge, everybody on their way somewhere. I want to go far. Jameson says, I know you know it will get better. I nod, closed-mouthed, in a gesture I believe to convey quiet bravery. Too little, too late. It's so hot and so close, you can almost lick the weather's face today. Steam rises off the East River. In a film, God kills herself by removing her own intestines. I don't have the guts to watch it. Jameson's poems are so rangy, on the bench like a godhead. My mother's arm is broken and strapped to her side on Skype. My dad calls me baby in a text when he's drunk. I don't know what this means. God's suicide scene. At the cinema last night, we didn't understand a thing, but we were so happy just to be there, not on our way anywhere. I want to go far, far. The film said loving someone was the only thing to do. And in it, one of the characters describes the music he listens to as soupy. It's a bad translation. Cory laughs and makes a joke in French, en soupçon. The film begins and ends with a woman covered in blood. And Andrew says maybe we're supposed to understand it all backwards. I guess that's how love works too. It's all faith until the end. And then you see it later for what it is or wasn't, what it could have been, the whole trick. When I see your face or hear your name, I want to pass out from love, from sadness, from shame and from regret. When I arrived in America, I wished simply to drown in feeling and forget about work. But then I got so wet, I had to start swimming. Steam rises off the East River. John Giorno says it's not what happens, it's how you handle it. I chew on language here. Philly cheesesteak, Rockaway Park, Taconic State Parkway, restroom, sidewalk. Mama, I'm so tired. Some days I take secret photographs of Americana and feel like a normal alien. Alice and I talk on the bench while the sun sets and watch the lights in the apartment building opposite turn on one by one. Last week I drank bourbon and cried for four nights solid, soaking through my sheets, my t-shirts and the mattress over and over. Fevery dream in which I see a drunk woman, me, doing shots and snorting coke from a key. I tell her, let me help you. Then I open a wound on her arm and remove from the wound a giant plastic egg. I crack the egg to reveal a small wooden sphere, and from it emerges a large white rat. Don't ask me how. I put the rat on a leash and walk it back to my apartment. I go to sleep in my dream petting the rat, and I wake up feeling good. I give the rat breakfast, which she eats happily. I kiss her head. I go back to the bar and find the woman, me, sicker than ever, thin, sweating, with two black eyes and a purple arm. I say, hey, what happened? And she says, you shouldn't have taken what you took the way you took it. You shouldn't have taken what you took the way you took it. You shouldn't have taken what you took the way you took it. I leave her on the floor to die. What do I care? I have my rat. Alice says I have the right to repeat myself, so I do. On the hot drive from Hudson, Kathy gets me to do impressions of different British accents and to describe the city I come from. When I get back to my apartment, I vomit in the kitchen sink, then the bathroom sink, then the toilet, then again in the shower. Pink ribbons of bile and wine. I am the only person at the John Giorno installation in Hell's Kitchen on a Wednesday afternoon, and I cry for 20 minutes watching him speak on a 20-foot projector screen. Thanks for nothing, America. I did it all without you. I sometimes wish a lesbian could be given this much room to do anything. You don't love me. And the feeling of not being loved comes in waves, steam rising off the East River. I kiss my rat's head. I'm such a bad peach. Seeing it all backwards. The world is so big. Desire alone makes it small. There's nothing funny about being a lesbian today, on my hands and knees like juiced fruit in prayer position at the gallery, the cinema, the bathroom floor. You shouldn't have taken what you took the way you took it. When I got back to the apartment, the rat was drunk. When I got back to the apartment, the rat jerked me off. When I got back to the apartment, the rat was me. Jameson gets me to stand on stage at the amphitheatre by the river to take a picture. Steam rises. I lose sight of him for a second, and it's just me and the water and the dog gently pissing. Self-help fake Rumi poem says, only when I quit believing in myself did I come to such beauty. There's a power in loneliness I need to channel. There's a freedom in not being loved I need to channel. It's not what happens, it's how you handle it. I came to America to be a solid gold flower floating down a river, and now reduced to repeating my own name out loud, my date of birth, where I live, the things I did today, splashing my face in the kitchen sink over and over. Honestly, I am sick of helping Jesus count days. My mother's limp white arm, the things she gave and took. Mama, I'm so sad. America begins and ends in blood. I want to go far, far, far. Sometimes I get off on meanness, the holding back the love that's bucking against the gate. Penny Arcade says that when she came to New York, she saw a sign at a head shop saying, "You are a daughter of the universe. This city is mine just as much as it's anyone's. Today is my 32nd birthday. I wish I had never been born. Andy Warhol was a fraud. Fame is a kind of violence. Ambition makes me sick. I want to close every door. I don't care about Kathy Acker. I don't care about anything anymore. There's no art in America. It's all sugar and war. I shouldn't have taken what I took the way I took it. But listen, wherever in the world, if I never see you again, always on your way somewhere, I will love you gently the whole length of my life. I want nothing for you but endless poetry, easy people, slow morning, strong coffee, dynamic emoji, time to read, dancing dog, uncracked screen, mountain, bunny, a million years, deep sense of peace, and somebody who loves you for free. When she sees your animal grace, your swagger, the way you open fruit, oh, I am glad to have known you, my devastating weakness, my white rat, my river of gold, and my old wild American heart."
Thank you so much, Sophie. That was amazing. Ilya, would you like to read a poem for us?
There's tears rolling down Rachel's cheeks for the benefit of the tape.
Thank you for the very moving poem. I'm going to read a really short poem called "Before the War, We Made a Child." Before the war, we made a child. I kissed a woman whose freckles aroused the neighbors. She had a mole on her shoulder, which she displayed like a medal for bravery. Her trembling lips meant come to bed. Her hair, water falling in the middle of the conversation, meant come to bed. I walked in my barber shop of thoughts. Yes, I weaved her off to bed on a chair of my hairy arms. But parted lips, when bite my parted lips, lying under the cool sheets, Sonia, the things we did.
Thank you.
Lovely.
What I love so much about your book are the strange and sort of brilliant aspects and sort of props that occur. The things I consider to be the backdrop and necessary parts of the book, the essential props, the kind of lurid puppets, the tomato sandwiches, all the laundry and people taking baths together. You weave the touching intimate aspects of life with the larger narrative in a way that seems to privilege intimacy and the domestic as a resistance to the action of the poems, like these small things can save us somehow. Was this a sort of intended feeling?
This is a very large question, so there are probably 77 different ways to answer it. I will probably only try three. The first is true for all of us. I suppose, and that is how lucky we are to have this intimate relationship to language. It may be language of grief, it may be language of joy, but in the end, any relationship to language is joy. It turns loneliness into solitude, the ability of to be able to walk in any street and just talk to one single word in your mouth forever. Never really feeling alone, because you have this, for even not the whole poems, but fragments of poems by yourself or others that you can play ping pong with. That's an amazing thing. And that is the very first basic raw response of a poet, a question about privacy. But there are many others. You could go more specific, say, okay, this is a book about war. Why is there so much kissing going on? right? And the answer to that is partly because poetry is so much a part of academia these days. We grow to expect, okay, today in this class for 45 minutes we will talk about erratic poetry, and in the next class for 45 minutes we will talk about epic poetry, and in the next class for maybe 40 minutes, because I have to make an announcement, we're going to talk about political poetry and so forth and so on. That makes them incredibly shallow. So in our cultural understanding of something like poetry of witness is, oh yeah, we're going to witness tragic events right now. You know, but that is not the case in when you think about great poets of witness. I don't know, Miyosh for a previous century, Akhmadova, or in our time, somebody like Helen Forsher. The poets can be really funny. They can be extremely nuanced. They take so many asides. So much life is happening in the most dramatic moments, even if it's just a fly landing on a fingernail. The poetry is the art of attentiveness. Paul Celan says that attentiveness is a natural prayer of a human soul. So it is really the question of to how many registers of language and how many registers of the world we are paying attention to and in what situations. By the pigeon sleeping on a balcony when somebody's been arrested? Why is there a little boy peeing under a tree when somebody's grandmother is taken into a hospital? Why is there a pigeon cleaning feathers with a beak when you woke up this morning and Donald Trump is the president? You know, the world is having so many unexpected answers for us. And going to a different answer, far more specific, me personally, as I said, I didn't have fingers growing up, so the only language I had was a language of images. All those pigeons and boys finger under trees and people buying tomatoes and smelling them before they buy them was a language I knew. That was the language of senses. Somewhere Lorca says that poet is a professor of five senses. He doesn't say poet is a professor of creative writing at the university. He says poet is a professor of five senses. And we all answer that statement, that challenge of that statement in different ways. But I do think we have to deal with it.
Yeah, that's a wonderful answer. But there's plenty of business there to segue into another question to you, Sophie. I think about the epic, the political, and these and the erotic being these arbitrary borders or false borders. I mean, and your poetry is a kind of epic, political, erotic poetic. And it's also, it develops very clearly, it's kind of private language for, it's intimate language for more than one person. I'm going to ask you a nerdier question about form, because in your book there's lots of different kinds of line and there's sort of those internal line breaks, those tabulations and gaps. There's also a lovely prose line passages. Where do you start with form? Do you find that there's much difference between the first drafts and the shapes of poems? Are they kind of radically reformulated? Do you feel it's more intuitive? Are there sort of systems that you abide by or anything like that?
Systems. I wish I had systems. I would say that the prose elements of the book kind of came last in that TBH, the prose poems in the book are the oldest poems in the book. And my editor, Nathan Hamilton, who is a really wonderful editor, such a close reader of work. But we did have some beef about my line breaks because he found them to be, in his words, ostentatious. And I kind of saw what he meant in that, I think that, I don't know if maybe you can relate to this, Jack, but I had a poetics of my 20s and then I think I had a poetics of my early 30s. And I definitely found myself to be more confident in, I suppose, directness and less interested in
maybe obscurity or over decoration, but mm-hmm. there was the content of some of the oldest poems in the book, like it was important to me as part of the narrative arc of kind of alcoholism and trauma and recovery of the book that they were in there. So we got round it by making them all prose and like removing some of the, and that really helped me to edit them down and they became a lot smaller and they lost something for sure, but also I just kind of had to sacrifice a few poems to that.
I think there's something where, like, you, when you kind of know that you're, where form is sort of doing its own thing, it's sort of happening, it's something you're in, and then there's this, where, and then there's that sort of feeling when sometimes you're outside of form happening to it. And if you can get into that space where form is almost sort of occurring, that seems to be like a much more joyful experience than, and not easier, because it perhaps it's hard work to get into that mental space, but it's certainly it's sort of self-generating, that the momentum that comes through. And so a poem like Art in America, the way that it moves across the page, has that kind of feeling of freedom and movement, like it knows where it, like the poem knows where it's going, even when I wouldn't be able to say, oh, I reckon Sophie made that line break for this reason or something. So it's interesting to sort of hear that borne out, and that they are the sort of also poetry of place as well, in those last, you know, the New York sections, that's also kind of like a state of mind and where you're at as well.
And I think it was really a point in my life at which I was deciding whether to live or die. And I think I just didn't want to hold back. And I also wanted to write a poem that had like big dick energy and see what would happen. And I was I personally was in such a kind of like weird, stripped back state that it allowed something new to emerge, and I think all the strongest poems in the book were written that summer in that state, so most of the third section.
And that feels like a quite a kind of radical aspect to it. I mean, we've talked a bit already about disclosure, and I sort of don't want to go on about that because there's so much more in the book than just sort of like the kind of hyper lyric that we've talked about, but the sort of radical disclosure, it's I don't know about big dick energy. I know about perhaps that there's a queer energy to the book and that radical disclosure, and a tradition as well. Is that something that you're sort of, obviously something that you're aware of, but how does that configure in it, do you think?
In terms of the queer energy?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it's connected to big dick energy in that, like, I'm like, quote unquote, allowed to say big dick energy in a way that maybe you you wouldn't be. But also I was thinking about, like, Sam Walton's take that you mentioned on the history of the muse, and how it's so, like, awful and boring to be a woman having all these poems directed at you. But that does something. And I'm like in the corner, like, because all my poems do that, and the muse or the subject in my poems is always women.
Yeah.
And so I do write these sort of like pervy, lusty poems for women, for femmes. Queer desire in itself is like risky and has a kind of shameful history, and it's risky and exposing and vulnerable making as a queer person to articulate desire. And because of that risk, I think it's there's a different power dynamic between the subject and object.
Completely.
We've talked a little bit before in other episodes about, like, when a poem is re-embodied, and it's not a when it's a queer body or a black body, that suddenly that kind of embodied, like the death of the author, you know, author schmorther, you know, it's like, no, it's me, I'm talking, and this is being, I'm in these poems, it's my body that's at stake, it's my my position that's being articulated. And that does seem like a kind of like part of a radical tradition, but also one that's kind of enjoying a bit of oomph at the moment. And it's, I think that Rabbit really seems like a key text for me in that, in this kind of moment that it's happening.
Thank you so much, Sophie Robinson and Ilya Kaminsky, for coming in and talking to us today. Ilya Kaminsky's Deaf Republic is out now with Faber and Faber, and Sophie Robinson's Rabbit, published by Boiler House Press in 2018.
And thank you, who knows which section of the bookshop you can find either of them
exactly.
in.
Exactly. Probably but poetry.
Probably though. Poetry. Thank you both
thank
for
you.
Coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Cause. And to the burning I say, my worry is a whole country. I've been myself longer than my undoing. Heavy trunk of silverware, museum glass polish, portraiture of bent flags. I'm here as my grandparents were, only with a moving mouth. During empire, my people were subjects first, citizens later. Once the vigilantes managed to zip up their coats, flames lambent. My grandmother died with umbrellas outstretched in her gut. My grandmother died. To be British is to be everywhere. Some roots have been in the earth for so long, they know only to call themselves earth. A worm's pink nipple bleeds into snow. My birth, my mother's brown skin. I'd already filled half myself with Britannia's air. It took them a month to find my name.
I love Anthony's poetry because there's such an epic range of emotion, geography, address, subject, and it never feels like too much. It always feels so entirely contained and controlled and managed. Mm. Not that anything ever has to feel like that, but there's something about, I don't know, the stress that he puts on the scope of the worlds that he creates within his poetry that amazes me.
It's so rich, but it doesn't feel like overburdensome, the amount, the amount of material and image that's kind of pulled in. It's a bit like, you know, a culinary metaphor. It's like if it's a rich sauce, but it's not like, whoa, so rich. You know, if you eat like a cheap box of chocolates or something, you're just like, I feel sick. Like this is, I think the way in which he's sort of like, it's a really rich source.
And to do another metaphor.
Sweet.
It's filmic. The poems, when I read his poems and when I hear that poem and hear other of his poems, we travel through scenes. And they're so carefully laid out, so quickly laid out, so well mapped. When I read them and when I see them, I feel like I'm being pulled through some kind of cinematic experience. And there's something about the controlled rawness of how he treats history and how he treats personhood and what it means to be a person. And there's so much pain and suffering in his poetry, but it feels all entirely human and usual, which is what pain and suffering as a human is. It's like daily. And obviously it's so much more than just a universal effort, because it's about migration and it's about race and it's about class.
He's like... There's so much history, like in the work, but it never feels like it's being pulled in. It feels like in the way that we do experience or occupy our place in history, like we haven't just when we're not, you know, we don't arrive newly into a new context. I think like the poems kind of like happen in a context that's already happening. I don't know, it's very difficult to sort of pin down how it works.
I can't talk, I find it really, really hard to talk about this poem and Anthony's poems in general because they completely just sort of blindside my capacity. I can't paraphrase him.
The heresy of paraphrase.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that's the true of all of the poets that we have on here. But there's something uncontainable. And there's so much influence and there's so much, you know, work behind it. And I feel like his poetry is really close to like philosophy or like philosophizing on life.
I
feel like it's just all there. Like
the portraiture of bent flags. I mean, that's like, that's big talk. You've got portraiture, which is just like a really good kind of noun there. And it's sort of like it's quite open and it's very specific, but then you've also got like these bent flags, like it's just like a really complex but it works.
And he does that so much in the collection as well. There'll be shifting between pronouns, shifting between subject, and there's a really interesting way in which he sort of places or the author places their own body in these various contexts, but it's still so presently there. This poem is from After the Formalities, right?
Yeah.
And reading that book in its entirety, the book will be out in September with Pen in the Margins. I cry every single time as I'm reading this book because of the power, but also just because how good the poems are.
Worm's pink nipple that bleeds into snow. I mean, that's just like, yeah. It's sort of weird. There's a sort of like lots of flavours of sort of like Lorca-ishness. There's
Blakean visions.
Elliot. I mean, these are big chaps here.
You see it with the long poems as well, I think, that he wrote. You know, After the Formalities itself is this sort of like long, dense, repetitious, relentless kind of appeal and address to something.
Yeah.
And I think the way that Anthony manages long poetry is, again, I haven't seen anything like it.
No, it feels like this, it's a very, like, you know, when you're reading this book that there's, I don't know, you can see the work of thought. Like, sometimes you can see, like, the emotional work that a book has taken, the cost, and that's there too. But I think you can see, like, you can see deep thinking, like, behind these poems.
The reason I think Anthony's poetry in this collection is so important is because it sits at the epicentre of so many different styles and ways of writing.
Yeah.
It's formal, it's experimental, it's sound-driven, it's colloquial at times, it's got this high register, and it's all managed entirely within these short poems or long poems that just feel so masterful. There's just no other word for it.
Yeah. I suspect that it's a power that's sort of quite, it still feels quite humble. It's not like it's not booming.
Completely.
It's like a very like that's also part of its like quality and charm.
It's politics. Its politics is, you know, inherently like it's addressing historical discrepancies and historical injustices, social injustices. It strives for a kind of humbleness of self, a humbleness of politics. It's like an equalizing force. It has such a power, its powerful agenda is the fact that it's inherently a peaceful collection.
Yeah. It's a good collection, you know, like a collection of good.
It's a force for good.
Yeah. I totally agree. And I feel like...
It's hard because obviously we've only listened to this poem, but the whole, it makes me think so much about what the entire collection does.
Yeah.
Which will, be out with Penned in the Margins September this year.
And next up, we have our final audio postcard from Hugo Williams. It's a poem taken from his new collection, Lines Off.
Hugo Williams, recalling an early friend, Tara Brown, the male Guinness heir, who he met in Paris in 1960, when Tara was 15 and I was 17. Tara was an iconic figure in swinging London, and no sooner had he come to London than he met the great pop stars and became a close friend of Brian Jones and Paul McCartney, and made it into the famous song A Day in the Life by John and Paul. I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. That's Tara. He was born in 45 and died in 66. 1966, so 21. Very sad. If you'd apologised just once for green shirts and amethyst cufflinks, you might have survived. But who would have believed that Irish ironical, sorry, as you fell about laughing? You were only 15 when we followed you across Paris after midnight, trying to keep up. If our money ran out, you pretended to find a D-meal note lying in the gutter, our student grant for the further study of Bloody Marys and rock and roll. You had the latest American singles under your coat in case the clubs weren't cool. Cut Across Shorty by Eddie Cochran was your signature tune when you rubber-legged it across the floor of the Club de l'Etoile, smoking a Salem. After hours, we took your portable singles player to the Aerogare des Invalides with its photomat and coffee machine, dancing for the cleaners. Summertime blues. Come on, everybody. Our faces of children are squashed together fighting in the faded photo strips. We were still dancing when Eddie flew through the windscreen of a British taxi, followed to heaven by his precious flame-coloured Gretsch. We all came home from the party safe and sound, but you didn't come home. You went on into the night, dancing your crazy doodle step on the pedals of your turquoise Lotus Elan, till the music stopped in the middle of Redcliffe Gardens at midnight, December the 17th, 1966. It was the midway point of a broken-backed decade. Before it, the miniskirt, the twist, I Want to Hold Your Hand. After it, long hair, old clothes, a day in the life. Tara, the day you died, your friends went out of date. Now there's a thought you would definitely have agreed with.
You've been listening to the Faber Poetry Podcast, presented by Jack Underwood and Rachel Allen, produced by Jack Underwood, Rachel Allen, and Hannah Marshall for Faber and Faber. You can listen to us on all your favourite podcast platforms, and don't forget to tell your friends and subscribe.